It's my pleasure to now introduce our keynote speaker for the day, Dr. David Bundy. He's currently serving as the Associate Director of the Manchester Wesley Research Center, a role he's held for about 10 years. Now, I realized yesterday when I was introducing him to Dr. Shepherd that in publishing his connection to Manchester, I may have given you the impression that he was going to come and speak with a charming British accent. So I don't want to disappoint you, but he's not British. He is, in fact, American, though I think you have quite a nice speaking voice, David. I do enjoy listening to you. But he is American, but he spent a great deal of time abroad. He is a specialist in Methodist, Holiness, and Pentecostal history, focusing primarily on issues outside of North America, as well as on early Asian and East African Christianities. He's had extensive international experience, having served as a lecturer in 44 countries, having taught grad-level courses at 28 institutions. He also served as a librarian and historian at Asbury Seminary, Christian Theological Seminary, and as Associate Provost for Library and Information Technology and Associate Professor of History at Fuller Theological Seminary. And he has degrees from Seattle Pacific University, Asbury Seminary, the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, and Uppsala University in Sweden. Now, his publications list is truly extensive and covers fields as diverse as early Syriac and Armenian Christianity, radical holiness traditions in France, Scandinavia, Korea, and countless other places, as well as the history of the Wesleyan and Pentecostal movements in the Anglosphere. Now, I will confess that last evening, as I was looking over Dr. Bundy's publications list and trying to digest its scope, I was becoming a bit overwhelmed. So I turned to AI to analyze the CV that I was looking at and tell me what I was looking at and how many items were there. And actually, I think it broke AI, David. Took several minutes, actually, for it to figure out what to do. But in the end, it came back and there were over 700 items on the publication list, around 250 book reviews, a similar number of encyclopedia entries, over 200 essays published as journal articles and chapters and so forth. But, you know, David wears all of these accomplishments very lightly, I would say. He is always eager to celebrate the work of others and to mentor and encourage younger scholars. And I've been the beneficiary of that. In the years I've known him, I've found him to be unfailingly kind and humble and generous and gracious. And it's a blessing to have him here at Tyndale. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Bundy.
After hearing that introduction, you may be disappointed by more than the sound of my accent, but thank you very much for your gracious introduction. Redeeming humanity in flawed empires. This is our subject for today, and it is a subject that seems forever pressing. Empires have always been flawed, some more egregiously than others. Most of them have had people from the inside who have tried to improve them and to improve the experience of the people who are suffering inside and sometimes outside. Today, I want us to focus on radical holiness movements in the UK and in France. I use the word net movements there, but I actually prefer networks because the history of Christianity is often viewed as denominational histories. You have Anglicans, you have Lutherans, you have Presbyterians, you have Pentecostals, and of course, in each of these categories, you have bunches of them, but rarely do people look at who's being related to across those silos. And the radical holiness networks of the 1860s and onward up until the fundamentalist modernist controversies took over, reached across these lines when they made common cause to fulfill what has been a Wesleyan impulse, sanctification. And by sanctification, they took Wesley's definition of that: to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. Now, these were not the first people to be concerned with the issues of exploitation. They were not the first people to be concerned with the problems of empire. They were not the first people to be concerned for the poor, but they were. And so it's that story today, or part of that story, a tiny part of that story, that I want to call to your attention and for us to think about. It's important to note, speaking of England, the UK, and France, that the experience of the Protestants in those two countries is quite different and has been forever. The Protestants in France, after the wars of religion had decreased their French percent of the percentage of the French population from 40% to around 2%, where it remains today, more or less, they never recovered from that war, and that defined their identity. They have understood themselves as the people who lived in the desert, which is where many of the Protestants in southern France hid during the wars of religion and the repression that followed the end of the Edict of Toleration. In the UK, the evangelical movements had grown thanks to the nonconformists and thanks to this gentleman who we celebrate today, John Wesley, and his peers in the evangelical revival. And they are forever part of the background story of the radical holiness networks. Now, as a way to get at this huge web of people, and everybody has to have a scientific method, right? So mine are sticky notes, little yellow ones and pink ones and whatever. And so I have a wall where I start to put, here's this person here, and I found them cited in this person's periodical and are speaking at this person's place. And then I find that they're way over here talking to somebody else, and I never do figure out who all their friends are, because there are so many of them, you can't look them all up and you can't find them. So today, to focus us, I wanted us to look at two people who have become friends of mine. The first one is Josephine Butler, whose maiden name was Gray, Josephine Gray Butler, whose dates, just to give you historian geeks the pleasure of being able to place her better, her dates 1828 to 1906. She was, a large period of her life, a scandalous woman. And I will explain to you a little bit the basis of that scandal. But she early on came to understand that the unchecked power of the politicians and the justice system and the exploitative economic and social conditions were being very bad to women who were then caught in an entangled world of crime. During her life, she was scandalous, but now she is celebrated as a patron saint within the Anglican tradition, and her day is celebrated on May 30th, so it's coming up. One of the biographies of her is entitled The Patron Saint of Prostitutes. She has been understood in the historiography primarily as an Anglican, And even the people who have come to study her later say she's an Anglican, but she just doesn't quite fit. She has all these funny friends, Salvation Army, sensationalist publisher W.T. Steed. She's running off and talking at these conferences where people talk about religious stuff that's really kind of mushy, like holiness. And so the her identity as a person, as theologically, has ignored the vast networks of these radical holiness people that she related to. And so it's some of these that I want to focus on today. Josephine Butler came from a Wesleyan evangelical and politically a Wesleyan Anglican evangelical tradition and a politically progressive activist roots. Her grandmother was bounced on the knee of none other than John Wesley, who stayed at the family home when he was in the north of England, in Northumberland. Family members were national and regional reformers, and many of her relatives were her key supporters in Parliament. Her father was a sort of agricultural missionary who helped farmers find methods of farming that nourished both them and the nation and the soil. She was raised by a devout Methodist governess who introduced her to Wesley's theology, including the understanding of sanctification and of service. As a teenager, she had a religious crisis, and she became a lifelong critic of formulaic Christianity and of formulaic holiness. In her diary as a teenager, she wrote, "Social holiness, social Christianity is not interesting." By social Christianity, she didn't mean what we need come to mean as like social gospel. She meant polite Christianity, polite holiness. That is, no ethical impulse attached. It's unclear to me and to everybody else when she first came in contact with William and Catherine Booth. Although the press coverage of the Salvation Army was constant, it was also quite negative. It was at least as early as the first issue of The War Cry in 1879. The Salvation Army occupied Liverpool on the 4th of August, 1879, and at some point that I have been unable to identify, as part of her activism, she found herself in London in need of prayer and attended a Salvation Army a meeting in which she found answers within herself and from God through her prayers. In 1891, in 1883, she wrote a book about the Salvation Army in Switzerland, where she had accompanied them in their incursion into Switzerland. With Kate Booth, La Maréchale, who was a close friend of hers. In an 1891 interview for All the World, and again in an article in the same periodical published in 1895, she remembered that first fascicle of The War Cry. "I read every word of it, and I cannot tell you how I felt." She recalled her continuous attendance at the Salvation Army meetings while she lived in Liverpool. She wrote Catherine Booth, "I always went even to those awful meetings when you had such riots. And oh, I have found such help and such and blessing in army meetings." It is probable, but not determined, that she attended the Oxford Conference for the Promotion of Holiness, where most many European radical holiness activists were in attendance. She indicated that her husband did, and she became a very close friend of Hannah Whittall Smith, from this period. And that is, and the closeness of that relationship is documented in extant correspondence that's preserved not in Butler's correspondence, but in Smith's correspondence. Josephine never wanted anybody to write a biography of her life. But it was beginning in Liverpool in 1869 that Butler began her crusade, what she called the cause, focused on the institutionalized injustices to women in the UK and Europe, centered on the Contagious Diseases Act. These were acts of Parliament passed in 1864, 1866, and 1869 that attempted to control venereal disease in the British Army and in the male population of Britain. Women were considered diseased until they were proven well. Vulnerable working class women, not only in the sex trade, were forced into what Butler called the steel rape, that is, the forced vaginal examination by male doctors. All it took was the accusation of one man against any woman to have her humiliated and examined. Victorian society blamed the women, not the men, for prostitution and disease. Butler and her colleagues, the Radical Holiness colleagues, took a different point of view. The National Association for the Repeal of the Contagious Acts, there's not only women who were upset about this, some of the men were too, but when the association was begun, it was limited to men. Butler, with a friend, established the Ladies National Association for the Repeal of the Contagious Diseases Act. She campaigned vigorously for the repeal in prayer meetings and in churches. She organized social protests and events in public and private venues, and lobbied members of Parliament, supporting those who advocated repeal and speaking against those, exposing those who did not. She spoke to women. She spoke of women and sex in ways that scandalized nearly everybody in Victorian England. She provoked riots. She provoked arson attacks. She provoked press attacks. And she inspired and cooperated with co-agitators across the UK and Europe, clergy wives, journalists, socialists, liberal parliamentarian philosophers, politicians, including Garibaldi of Italy, whose name you will recognize, the Evangelical Alliance, the Radical Holiness activists, atheists, anybody who would work with her for the repeal of the acts. She reached across those silos. And many people in those silos were already engaged locally in radical holiness networks, women and men. Now, tracing those becomes a huge task, and so I want us to focus only on one periodical, what it reveals about her. It's a periodical that is really hard to find. I've never seen a paper copy of it. Not that they don't exist, but I haven't found it. It's entitled Methodist Protest. Now, in 1875, in order to speak to the situation in France and to address laws there, she was invited to Paris to develop the European branch of the Crusade. And the Methodist Protest magazine, the subtitle of it is The Organ of the Wesleyan Society for Securing the Repeal of the Contagious Diseases Act, was edited by Hugh Price Hughes. Its tone was set in 1876 by William Arthur, who was the author of a book that is still in print in several languages entitled Tongues of Fire, used by Pentecostals and Holiness folks, Methodists, and a few others. In the lead article, he said, "We know that in Paris, year by year, the men charged with these dark affairs call for more power and law and more degrading regulations. We know that already progress in this direction has advanced among ourselves here in England far beyond the point at which, or would have advanced far beyond the point where it stands, had voices not been raised in protest, in pain, in shame, but under the resistless compulsion of conscience. Such voices must be raised under the same moral necessity as long and as hard as a struggle to undo the evil. And that until it is done, that struggle must be maintained." Arthur was, in some ways, the keystone for the Radical Holiness Networks, also in France and also in England. There, many of all of her activities in France were reported in this journal. It's the best source for actually understanding what she was doing, where she was going, and what she was saying. And it's there that we find the second person who I'm going to introduce to you today, Theodore Monod. But before we get to him, we have to go back to Paris. Paris became the focus for Butler and the Radical Holiness Networks, supported by Monod and, of course, William Arthur's word, but not his legacy. He was becoming too, or by his presence, he was becoming too ill to participate, but he wrote letters and he published. Butler's essays during this time talk about the rich men of Paris and the poor women of Paris. They talk about the actual really detailed analyses of the laws in France that have also been copied for England. And she talks about the efforts of the French holiness networks to get rid of them. And in France, there were few people other than the holiness networks that were opposed to these regulations. Now back to the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army and Butler's work in France are very closely intertwined. And I want to only mention four moments of their cooperation. First, there were numerous Booth-Butler appearances at meetings contesting for women's rights. I love the posters with Butler and Kate Booth on them. I love the newspapers where their pictures show up in the same place. Second, in 1881, in France and Switzerland, as I mentioned a moment ago, supported by Butler, Theodore Monod, and other French radical holiness activists, Booth and her troops were harassed by mobs of men opposed to the Salvation Army version of Christianity, their attacks on the sex and alcohol trades, and their perceived activism in favor of the marginalized churches, which would have been news to the churches, but the people who didn't go to church thought they must be supporting, trying to get them to force them back to church. In the midst of the Swiss struggles in 1882, she wrote to Catherine Booth, "There is not a day, scarcely an hour, in which I do not think of you and your fellow workers. Rejoice in the tide of blessing when our eyes are, which our eyes are privileged to see. My own duties, domestic and public, have kept me from being among you as often as I would, but I doubt if there is anyone who is more with you in spirit than I." She wrote this in the middle of a riotous time in Switzerland, from Switzerland, where the lives of the Salvation Army officers were in danger, and many of them, including Kate Booth, ended up in a prison. The third time that I want to mention, as the crusade to repeal the laws hung in the balance of Parliament, she implored Florence Bramwell Booth, William Booth's daughter-in-law, to solicit the prayers of the Salvation Army, my dear friends at Bethshan, and a few others, consecrated rescue workers. But I would not have any join with us in prayer who is not of one mind and heart with us. The fourth case I want to mention is the Eliza Armstrong case of 1885. Concerned with the national sex trafficking, an international sex trafficking of young girls to wealthy men on the continent, and being mocked for their concern by the press and the government, W.T. Stead, the sensationalist author, newspaper publisher, and who famously sank on the Titanic, Butler, Catherine Booth, Bramwell Booth, and William Bramwell Booth, Florence Bramwell Booth, William Bramwell Booth, decided to prove that a young girl could be purchased in London, transported to the continent, and kept in sexual slavery. With the help of Butler's a protege of Butler, a girl was purchased, transported to Belgium and France, and kept at a Salvation Army hostel. Stead published the details of this in the Pall Mall Gazette, and it broke all records of the publication. Original copies were selling the same day for 1,000 times the original asking price of the paper. Bramwell Booth, Stead, and the associate Jarrett were tried and imprisoned. Frank William Crossley, the industrialist from Birmingham, from Manchester, who had the patent on the gasoline engine for every place outside of Germany for decades, and was a holiness billionaire, paid their bail and legal fees. Stead refused to leave, stayed in prison, and wrote a biography of Butler. He also would later write those on Catherine Booth and William Booth. But Butler was protected by all involved, and nobody wanted to be guilty of putting Butler in jail. It was a happy ending in the end, and it sold a lot of newspapers. But quickly moving on to Theodore Monod. Some of you may have heard of him. If you like religious music, you may find him there. That's mostly what he's known for in the Anglophone world. In the French world, they prefer to ignore him because he doesn't quite fit the categories, because he wasn't exactly free church. He was for a while Église libre, as they say. He was not exactly Reformed church, the Église réformée. He wasn't exactly a foreigner, but he had foreign connections. He didn't fit, and none of his papers survived. His sons, his father, his grandfather, everybody else in the family, the papers are preserved. His are not. So we have to hunt for Theodore. He came from a prominent French Protestant family. His father was Frédéric Monod, the brother of Adolphe Monod, who famously excluded parishioners in Lyon from the Eucharist in the Reformed Church for not being sufficiently consecrated, sufficiently holy in life and deed. This did not go well. He was fired, and he started his own congregation, which joined the Free Church organized by his brother. The career of Frederick the Father included prison ministry, hospital chaplaincy, pastor to the bourgeois-dominated free church that became the mother church of the Église Libre in France, and which the church in Lyon joined, And he established to minister among the poor the La Chapelle du Nord, which is near the North train station in Paris, for those of you who have wandered about there. In 1858, he decided he needed more money to build that church, and he came to the USA to try to raise it. He brought with him Theodore, who had freshly minted with a law degree from the Sorbonne, and but Theodore happened to get caught up in a revival in New York City and got converted. He decided to become a Presbyterian pastor and was assigned to a French-Canadian congregation close to what is now a suburb of Kankakee. Those of you who are aware of Nazarenedom will know about that place. But he was there for a couple of years until he was called back in 1863 to take over his father's church because his father had gotten too ill to serve. And so Frederick went back, bilingual in English and French, to take over that church and to be the pastor. He quickly became an interpreter of what was happening in the United States on the abolitionist side. He spoke in favor of the North, the cause of the North in the U.S., and for the freedom of the slaves in the United States, and was, I think, quite influential in bringing the Evangelical Alliance on the continent into support of the Union cause. He was invited because of his preaching and his holiness revivalism that he had picked up in the States but had adapted significantly. He was invited to speak at the Broadlands Conference in the south of England, and then at the Oxford and Brighton Conferences for the promotion of holiness that were organized by William Boardman and Smith. And it's in that context that he first came into contact, as far as I can tell, with Butler. But when he got back to France, he decided, I've really got to keep spreading this stuff. And he was encouraged to do that by his friends with whom he had traveled to the British events. And so he started publishing books, booklets on the various conventions. He edited a collection of sermons. He wrote a little book about this is what that whole thing means. It's not what you read in the press. This is the truth about it. And he decided he needed to find somebody to pastor the church. He was too busy, and he knew that. So he invited a fellow by the name of Dieterlen. You don't need to worry about the name. Sorry almost to mention it, except he's a very interesting guy who is a part of the family of Alsatian philanthropists, industrialists, who supported humanitarian and pietist causes. And he had become a holiness believer through the influence of Monod. He came, he worked in the church his last year, ministering to the poor, and then he died. There's one more guy I know who was blessed. It was Tommy Falot. For those of you who are aware of French Protestantism, Tommy Falot is close to a saint. And it's so interesting to me to see how his legacy has been interpreted and by whom. The holiness, the whole idea of entire consecration of holiness might have been lost in France had it not been for him, because he was able to do for a while what people were not being able to do in the fight between liberals and pietists influenced people in the French Reformed Church. He was able to hold together the issue of heart for God and a heart for people. Later, he would almost give up on the church part. He said, you know, these people are just too stuck in this. But he leaned back on his Strasbourg thesis, which was entitled The Gospel and the Poor. And he leaned back on that to become a leader in thinking about how one starts to work in the church to maintain this Wesleyan synthesis of love of God and love of neighbor. Now, Theodore Monod kept doing all these prayer meetings all over France, but he also started a periodical, and the name of the periodical he chose is really interesting. It's The Liberator. There were only two other Liberator periodicals at that point in the French and English-speaking worlds. The one in France had already died, but the one in North America, the one in the States, was published by William Laurie Gerritsen, who argued for abolition as a Christian responsibility. And the one in France was published by the socialists, who argued for social responsibility, but without the Christian part. It's clear to me, reading through that periodical, which is the best anthology we have, published over 5 years, of Theodore Monod's thought, that it was the combination of those two that were in the back of his mind as he frames how one lives responsibly as a Christian in an age of empire. The meetings that he started continued and continued all the way through the beginning of World War II. He did his last ones about 1918, with a break for the war, for the First World War, for the Great War. Now, he was not the only Holiness periodical in business. There were two others. The one entitled La Chambre Haute, the Upper Room, and one entitled Mission Intérieure, the Inner Mission, both of which were totally Holiness periodicals that have also escaped the ravages of time in very few copies and very few full copies. Now, I need to come back to the Salvation Army, having gotten a little bit ahead of the story. The Salvation Army, quickly with the financial support of Crossley and other donors from Switzerland and from France, purchased numerous properties across France, including in Paris. They very quickly and early, even before the publication of, in 1900, of, or probably 1890, of Darkest England and A Way Out, were providing services to the poor in collaboration with a Scottish Presbyterian Holiness minister, Macaul. His Mission Populaire Evangelique is still going. They aided in instances of national disaster. They hadn't planned on it. Natural disaster, they hadn't planned on it, but there were some floods near where they were, and they, with their uniforms, were quite visible in taking care of people. Turbulent years and decline followed the time of La Maréchale, but La Maréchale and her efforts in Paris were transformed by none other than D.L. Moody. Moody came to preach in France, and he invited her to sit on the platform with him and the other sophisticated clergy of the Reformed churches, Lutheran Church, English language churches, Methodist Church of France. And then at the end of this crusade, everybody in Paris was assigned by Moody an area of the city of France, or Paris, to evangelize and canvass and give out tracts. The brethren exhibited total passive aggressiveness and did not participate in that. The only section where that was accomplished was that where La Maréchale had organized her troops. Now, Theodore had a son who he sent to study and encouraged to study theology in the south of France at the Protestant theological faculty that is today in Montpellier. He is an important figure. His father is ignored, but Wilfrid is everywhere in French Protestantism, in a French Protestant history. When he was at Montauban, where the faculty was then, he organized class meetings. He didn't call them that. He called them reunion meetings, consecration meetings for the students. Out of that group of students come all of the participants except Tommy Fallot, of the earliest group of people who were supporting Christianisme Social in France. That first generation who once again held together the love of God and love of neighbor. He wrote a book, a two-volume set, Cloud of Witnesses, in which he talked about all the people who were part of the, who he should line up, and who lined up in this thing of saints. And he starts with the early church and eventually talks about various Catholic saints, just as Wesley and Josephine Butler did, and Theodore Monod, and then he lists, you know, people we know and love, Labousse, Fallot, and other French and British holiness folk, and Wesley, of course. Now, these are personal stories of that don't stop with them, as I mentioned. One of the people who became involved, a student of Wilfrid, becomes the founder of Pentecostalism in France, but never became part of a Pentecostal denomination, France and Belgium. The legacy lives on in the social Christianity tradition, the Christianisme Social tradition. Butler's work lives on in different ways, because of the fact of the split after the fundamentalist modernist controversies. She is less honored in the feminist and in reformist tradition in Britain, although that is gaining as more publication, research, writing, and thinking and tolerance are evolving. So it's also a story of personal friendship between these two people and a lot of their connections in these radical holiness networks that span the continent, from what is now St. Petersburg to Spain, from Scandinavia to Italy, to the UK, and a tiny bit into North America. They understood that transformed lives needed transformed empires. And I don't know if you sensed as I was talking the class issues involved. These were people who had relative privilege. They were not princes, and they were not of the ultra rich. They had a supporter, Crossley, who was newly rich. He didn't really even understand what rich meant, and he didn't live that way. But in order to transform empires, you have to also have the engagement of the networks who have even the vision that they can be involved in the transformation of society. And so these holiness networks, for me, and I hope for you, may eventually give you access to for us for ways of thinking about our own roles as we go on in the Wesleyan tradition. Our tendency has been to say, oh, you know, those people are involved in social care. And being involved with social care, they think, you know, we're wasting our time if we spend our time going to church and praying a lot and going to making a lot of noise just doesn't, takes away from our project. And we have the people on the other side who often say, we are very, we don't want to get soiled. We don't want to talk to all those people. We want to be with people who believe like we do in our denomination, in our church, in our congregations. And for this brief moment within the history of France and the UK, you have these connections being made and maintained by these networks of people, not denominations, networks. So thank you very much. I hope we, if you have questions now or later as we go on, I would be happy to address those as we think together.